Welcome to Engaging Culture, a podcast presented by Bridgeway Christian Church. I'm Brian Kiley. On today's episode, my co-host Judah Sanders and I are going to talk about retirement. What does it mean? How should we think about it? We'll take a look at some new legislation regarding social media for young people and talk about the growing political divide between the genders in Gen Z. We'll, of course, have some fun along the way. All of that and more on this episode of Engaging Culture. Hello and welcome to season 5, episode 4 of the Engaging Culture podcast. Brian Kiley with you, as always, joined by Judah Sanders. Judah,
good
how are you?
Good morning. Good morning. If it's morning when you're listening, I'm good. I'm sleepy.
But I think this is going to be like our new thing is that when I throw to you, you say good morning, even though people may be listening to this as they're falling asleep.
I will also, for the sake of equity, say good afternoon, good evening. I don't know what other.
Got a little Truman Show dynamic going on here. Best thing you saw this week. Start us off.
Yeah. So I think the best thing that I saw this week wasn't actually something that I saw, but something that I listened to. There's an artist, I think out of Nigeria, named Manana, and he wrote this song called You First. And I don't necessarily agree with his position in the song, but basically it is him saying, I will adjust in my relationship, I'll apologize, I'll do what's necessary, but you have to do it first. And while I don't agree with that position, I think it's a little immature and doesn't really work for marriage. I loved the skill with which he wrote the song and built the song. And it's been a while since I've heard a really well-written song. I think that it's easy to kind of just throw something up there that's going to get, you know, the listens. But I really appreciate a well-written song.
There we go. All right.
And what about you?
The other night, my wife and I went to a concert. It was a string quartet playing Coldplay songs.
I saw that.
Which... I've gotten a million ads on Instagram. Finally, I just, okay, Instagram, you win. I will buy the tickets. And I like classical music. I don't love it. And I like Coldplay. I don't love them.
Careful.
Like, they're Coldplay. They're great. I'm not like a huge fan though. But it was cool. Like, we had a great time. It was kind of something a little different. I'm a sucker for sort of new experiences that are maybe outside of what I would normally do. So yeah, we just went down, enjoyed an hour of string quartet Coldplay music, and it was great.
Where were they doing this at?
It was at some random venue in like the Arden Arcade area that we were not certain existed until we pulled into the parking lot.
I was really prepared for you to say like some random venue and then name like a really big venue. I was
like
prepared
Golden
for you to be like,
One Center or
Golden
something.
One Center.
All right. So the first story we're going to look at today, there was a column in The Economist, came out January 22nd, and the headline was Why You Should Never Retire. Retirement, not a live issue for you or I at the moment, Pastor Judah, but the column went on to say, and this is even the subtitle of the headline, pleasure cruises, golf, and tracing the family tree are not that fulfilling. Obviously, we are not speaking from personal experience here, but what do you find problematic about some of the ways culturally we think about and talk about retirement?
I think a couple of things. One, I think that it's actually a bigger issue than retirement. I actually think we need to have a larger conversation about like how we work and how we think about work, how we think about vocational work. You know, the rhythms that we have kind of put in place around work, I'm not sure are so healthy. I'm not sure that you're supposed to work 6 days a week for 8, you know, to 12 hours a day and then have, you know, a day off. I'm not sure that that's the best rhythm. So I think that we start there with that discussion and even the ways that, I forget, I think it's Sweden that essentially when their kids graduate from high school, all of their children have the opportunity to, Sweden or Switzerland, have the opportunity to like go to school and study kind of just whatever they're interested in, regardless of money, regardless of status. And they link that directly to like how low their homelessness population is and how overall happy their people are. So I think that that's first. And then when we think about retirement, it's attached to age. And what's really difficult is I think we just throw old people away as a whole. We kind of decide that at a certain point in an old person's life, that their life is supposed to be reduced. to kind of not doing a whole lot of anything, which I'm not sure is life-giving. And so I think needing to reframe the idea of retirement being about more than just no longer working an 8-to-5, but some bigger pieces, some more fulfilling pieces in our lives, and to give people the flexibility, or to think about what do we need to give people the flexibility to change their life rhythm at a certain age in a way that allows them to do the things that they love and enjoy and are life-giving, and let those be the dominant things that they're kind of doing in their lives.
Yeah.
The article said that we should never retire, which is an interesting concept that I'm actually still chewing on. What do you think that that really means? What do you think is behind that? And is there another option between kind of full-time, you know, 40 hours a week, and also like full-time, like laying in the bed doing nothing at all?
Absolutely there is. And the last thing I want to do is tell a retired person what they should do. I myself am not retired. I have not walked a mile in that set of shoes. So I'm not here to tell anybody, well, this is what you ought to do. However, I feel like I just totally eliminated my disclaimer with the word however, but we're just going to roll with it. What the article was trying to say was kind of that idea of full-time leisure wears out, right? Full-time leisure is really fun for a while, but there is something innate within us that desires to contribute in some manner to society, to others. And I've seen this with my own parents, especially my dad worked full-time, very full-time for many, many years, and now he's retired. And it's been sort of interesting watching him navigate that transition to, okay, now he has more time for the things that he loves, but then also trying to figure out, okay, what are ways that I can contribute to the world as I am no longer working? And I think I've seen in him and in a lot of his peers that sense of like, yeah, it's really great that we have more time to play golf and play pickleball and to travel and like by all means enjoy those things. But there's also a deeper sense in which, okay, just because I'm no longer working for a paycheck doesn't mean I don't desire to contribute. And what's appealing to me as I think about retirement, even though it's many years in the future, is the idea of being able to think through and pray through, God, how might you be calling me to contribute to the world, but then not be bound by, but I need to get paid for it because I need to pay my bills and raise my kids and all of that. So I think that encouraging folks who enter that season of life to go, not from the sense of like obligation, like, are you doing enough? Yeah. Are you doing enough work? Are you don't play golf too much. Don't travel too. Like, I think that's very silly that we frame it in those ways, but rather to say, can we expand our horizons to think, what are our passion projects we can pursue now that we're not bound by this? I need to get paid. I don't know. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that that's important. I also think that particularly for men, perhaps, that there's this huge innate desire to provide.
Yeah.
And so I think needing to reframe what that looks like. Sometimes we only talk about providing kind of in one way. I have journeyed with men whose wives made more money than them, and they were kind of the stay-at-home in that kind of role, and they really struggled with that and needing to talk a lot about, hey, there's a lot of ways that you can provide for your wife, even if it's not financial. You know, you make sure when she gets home, dinner's on the table. You make sure that bath water is right. You know what I'm saying? You take care of what's yours. So I think that it's helpful for, and again, I don't want to tell people what to do and about an experience that I haven't lived, but I hope that when I am at retirement age, and I hope that it's the current age and not moved out, but I digress. I hope that I am able to look at my life, and when I'm asking that question about contributing in that season, that I have a really wide, nuanced way of looking at the idea of contribution.
Yeah.
So that I'm not feeling reduced by doing that, which is what I think can happen.
Yeah. Something the article said that I think is relevant to all of us, even as we're still working, there is a depth to being useful. And I love that concept. And even as a working person, to think about your life and go, I want to be useful, and to try to sort of spend your time and frame things through that lens. I think it's helpful for us working folks. I think it's helpful for students. And I think it can certainly be helpful for those who are entering into retirement.
One more question. I know that we're running out of time, but how do you feel like faith can influence the way we think about and approach this subject?
Possibility.
Oh, that's good.
Mm-hmm. Possibility. Mm-hmm. God is present and at work. Mm-hmm. There is new work to be done. There are new opportunities to pursue. There are new callings, not just for us as individuals, but collectively as part of the body of Christ, and we have a part to play. I think that mindset adds possibility and hope and purpose to any season of life, and certainly retirement is not exempt from that.
Love it. Well, welcome back, folks. We are looking at an article that came from The Guardian that talks about a law that they are trying to pass in Florida that essentially will prohibit those who are under 16 years of age from using social media and require media companies to verify the ages of other users. And the bill passed the House in Florida 106-13, with some comparing it to fentanyl and its addictive qualities in terms of social media's addictive qualities. One of the quotes from the article that was interesting said, "These dopamine hits from social media are so addictive, it's like digital fentanyl." And that's from a Republican state lawmaker who co-sponsored the legislation on the House floor. And essentially, what they're trying to do is make sure that there's a hard age limit to when you can have social media. And if you're under that age limit, getting parental consent. And so this is really interesting because this is the government kind of reaching into your home, your family, into the way you raise your children and making decisions for that. I'm wondering, as somebody who has kids, how do you feel about that? Do you feel like this law is necessary and do you feel like it's appropriate?
There are a lot of questions bound up in this law. Certainly one of them is, to what extent should the government be making decisions about what is and is not permissible for young people? And on the one hand, I can understand the perspective that says this feels like intrusion. On the other hand, we don't allow 15-year-olds to walk into a convenience store and buy cigarettes. We don't allow those companies to advertise. We create these types of laws for the protection of young people from highly addictive substances. And you referenced it was Fiona McFarland, a Republican state lawmaker in Florida, who co-sponsored this bill, comparing it to fentanyl. It's digital fentanyl because it is so incredibly addictive. And again, I think reasonable people can disagree about, do we feel this is a good thing or a bad thing in terms of, is it appropriate for the government to be making this decision? I'm a parent of children, right? That was redundant.
As opposed to, you know, rabbits. You know,
rabbits. That's right. My boys are 12 and 10. And we have talked for at least the last year, if not more. And I've made a joke about it. I've said, just so you know, you are being raised by lame parents who are not going to allow you to have social media until you're 16, 17 years old. And the reason for that is the research is entirely conclusive at the harm that social media has on young people. Now, I have boys. It is especially acute for girls. And I've talked to buddies who have, you know, preteen and teenage girls about some of the challenges that they face. A gentleman whose research I would highly recommend to anybody, his name is Jonathan Haidt, H-A-I-D-T. He's done a tremendous amount of work around the impact of social media on young people. And how it's highly correlated with depression, how it's highly correlated with suicidal ideation, how it's highly correlated with a withdrawal from physical spaces. And for all of those reasons, we can talk about, should this be a law or not? Personally, in our family, that is a principle that we are living by. And I tell my kids, the reason we are not going to allow this, even if all your friends have it, is because it will harm you.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, I think that you're right about needing to protect kids from the harm of being on social media too long and too early. I also recognize that it's probably difficult for us, especially as Americans, who are not huge fans of being told what to do, and who don't love the idea of this this outside entity making rules for how we raise our kids. And I think a part of that is just really desiring autonomy. Mm-hmm. And so I think this is going to be tough for folks. Do you think that this should be a law or just a practice that people implement in their own houses with their own children?
That's a really difficult question to
answer. Yeah, isn't
it? It's a really difficult question to answer. You know, it's funny. It makes me think about my son Matthew when he was 10. Mm. We went on a trip together, and we were walking in Boston, and we walked by somebody who was smoking. And, of course, the smell was very unpleasant. And Matthew goes, "Ugh, I just hate cigarettes. I wish we could
tell
just
me how you feel, Matthew.
I wish we could just ban them.
Don't hold back. You know? I can handle it."
And what was interesting is, of course, we've talked to our kids about the dangers of smoking and how it's a, you know, very unhealthy habit and everything else. But we had sort of an interesting discussion there about, like, well, really, should we ban? Should it be the job of, you know, whoever's leading our society to say, no, you cannot have this at all? And I said, well, what about banning this? What about banning that? And it was interesting to watch his wheels turn. So I think there is a space to go. I'm hedging on my answer here a little bit. Mm. Personally, I don't have a problem with it because that is a practice we're implementing in my household anyway. And the research demonstrates this is an active harm we are preventing by this law. But at the same time, like, I totally get the other perspective that says, no, this should be a guideline, not a law. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I'm kind of in the same place. I mean, I think that, you know, if we found out, it's funny that you mentioned cigarettes. When we found out that the ways that the flavored tobacco was being consumed by kids, we said we're no longer selling that in this state. If you look at some other countries in the world, I think it was Vietnam that had this huge opium crisis, and they eventually, you know, made a law that basically said if you are of legal opium consumption age currently, you can continue to buy opium till you die. But if you are not currently of that age, even when you become that age, you will never be able to have access to it because it's harmful. Mm. There are planes that we say, hey, we're no longer putting that up in the air because it keeps having issues.
Right.
So this feels similar to me. And I think that we just always need to unpack and interrogate the parts of us that rebel against authority and being told what to do, especially when it is backed up by research and it's for our overall health.
Yeah.
My question is, as believers, what sort of principles do we utilize to keep social media interaction healthy for all ages, not just for our kids, but for us as adults?
Yeah, there are some of these are uniquely Christian, others are not. Number one, I think when it comes to children, we as parents need to talk about this. One of so many issues, we need to just talk about it with our kids.
Yeah,
talk about social media. And I don't think we need to paint it as this like great Satan that's out to destroy you, but just have a really frank conversation about some of the benefits and challenges. Certainly we as adults need to model appropriate social media interaction, not only in our consumption, but certainly in our behavior. And then as Christians, we are called into community. Christianity is a team sport. For as individualistic as we are in America and as individualistic as we can get about even our faith practices in America, Christianity is not meant to be practiced solo. Mm-hmm. And so we have the opportunity to live out this profound and important element of our faith by continuing to allow ourselves to be drawn into community, continuing to encourage our young people to be in communal spaces where they have to look each other in the eye, and then doing that as adults and making sure that our offline life is where our real life is and not in this sort of online world that where we can get into all sorts of different rabbit holes.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that the reality is you cannot accidentally fall into rich, healthy community.
Yeah.
And so I think that we just have to go out of our way and esteem that the same way we esteem going out to get a job or going out to get your degree or going out to find a spouse, that it needs to be kind of in our top five things that we're doing with our lives so that social media actually doesn't have the same kind of draw and impact and doesn't feed us in that kind of addictive way.
Yeah. And recognizing even in us as adults, our proclivity for addiction, right? There's a reason why I have the little app timer time limit set at, you know, 10 minutes a day on Instagram, because you can just scroll your life away, right? To be able to put those things in place where you go, okay, I want to be cognizant of how addictive this can be for me, so that, again, I'm modeling health, not only for my children to observe in terms of like, oh, is dad on his phone again? But more like, oh, we're doing things with real humans. We're doing stuff that's actually requiring the give and take of human relationship, right?
Yeah, I think that's healthy.
The last topic we're going to cover on today's episode is around some research showing that over the last decade, polls are continuing to show that young people are growing more and more divided by gender on political issues. Since 2014, research is showing that women between the ages of 18 and 29 have steadily become more liberal each year, while men have not. Add to that, females in Gen Z are more likely than males to vote, to care about political issues, and participate in social movements and protests. Judah, what do you make of this divide in gender politics, so to speak?
I think a couple of things. One, I think that overall, women just have always kind of globally been a little bit better at organizing and at kind of gathering and curating resources. But I also think that this speaks to a demographic, women seeing a bigger need to be involved, a bigger need to be engaged in politics, that I think that they see that kind of engagement as really critical to their well-being, whereas I think overall men feel less, feel like it's less critical. And then, in the article, it talked about how the Me Too movement was really a galvanizing kind of moment for women that created kind of vehicles of solidarity. And the last thing that I'll say in terms of the article talked about how women are leaning more liberal. And I'm just always wanting to be careful about labels and what they mean, right? Because when we say women are more likely to vote liberal, what we're really saying, and even if we were to say they were to vote more conservative or that men are more likely to vote conservative, what we're saying is that there are this vast set of policies and ideas that women tend to be more interested in or men tend to be more interested in. And I think it's going to be really important for us to really look at those policies as individual policies and as a collective to see what is it saying that women care about or what is it saying that men care about and not just say, oh, it's liberal policies.
Sure. So if I'm hearing you correctly, you're saying it's a bit of a, it's not quite accurate to go, okay, women are liberal, therefore that means they think this way on 47 different issues, kind of what's the liberal viewpoint, but rather what you're saying is they are galvanized around particular issues and that tends to, they tend to think maybe perhaps more liberally on those specific issues, therefore they end up kind of going that direction, at least in the way that kind of we're talking about it societally.
I think so. And I think that it's helpful, no matter kind of what side of the aisle you sit on, to when you see those words, to say, okay, what are these words really mean, right? So when we look at these policies, what kind of policies are they? Are they justice policies? Are they equity policies? Are they economic policies? Are they security policies? And that will help us to get a better idea of like, okay, maybe it's that women are not feeling as safe or as included or as seen and are looking for policies that speak to those things. And I think that that's critical no matter kind of what side of the aisle you're on, because at the end of the day, you are going to need women to vote if you're going to win policy if you're going to win policies, you know, whether it's in Congress or in other spaces and vice versa, right? If when we see conservative, they say conservative policies, we should say, okay, what kind of policies are they? Often those are largely economic policies. So that tells us that folks who vote that way have a high value for living in a world where they can make enough money and take care of themselves and their families.
Right. Yeah, that's absolutely correct. And one thing that really stood out to me in the article was in the articles that I've read about this are just the galvanizing effect of the Me Too movement. And you talked about that a little bit ago. And that raises a few questions for me, and maybe they're a little bit naive. But one of them is truly, okay, so the Me Too movement obviously galvanized women to share their stories of vast different types of mistreatment, right? And that ended up driving women left and then creating this sort of reaction on the right. And I'm caricaturing this a little bit, but I guess I just asked the question of why did that have to happen? Why did this issue of women telling their stories of abuse and mistreatment have to turn into a partisan thing? And then subsequently, and I've seen this on issues of gender, I've seen this on issues of race, that it's almost like there is this segment of society that goes so quickly to the overreaches. Oh, well, it's gone too far, without actually respecting, no. Okay, maybe it has gone too far in a limited number of cases. But in the vast majority, for example, of women sharing their experiences that were in line with the Me Too movement, in the overwhelming majority of cases, we're talking about legitimate mistreatment. And it just makes no sense to me that right, left, center, whatever, that's going to impact the way we think about, okay, somebody sharing their story of mistreatment and abuse. I guess I just, again, maybe this is naive. To me, that doesn't feel like something we need to be dividing on partisan lines. And I don't know what I'm missing here, but it certainly seems like that's what we're doing and it's unnecessary.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I mean, I think a lot of it is that the Me Too movement doesn't exist in a vacuum, right? Like we're in this, I feel like, kind of time as a country where a lot of things that were once normalized, that once got the pass, just no longer do. Yeah. And so now we're all having to consider what we value, and we're having to consider disrupting certain systems, certain comforts, certain norms in order to make the world more safe. And I just think that change can be really, really scary. And I also think, I know for me, one of the hardest things about the Me Too movement was seeing folks that I really respect and looked up to be called out for it and be held accountable to it. I think about Bill Cosby. I mean, I grew up watching Bill Cosby, loved that man, loved that show. And it was painful to hear these accusations and then have to think about, okay, so what does that mean in terms of how I engage with Bill Cosby and his work, how I think about him? And so I think all of that change is really hard. I think the other thing is that in our society, we have a society that I feel like really undergirds and supports sexual harassment. Mm-hmm. And when it's baked into the culture, then it means to change. It means to undo or dismantle parts of that culture. And it's like, that's kind of our whole world. And so it means now I have to think about, as a man, how do I engage with women in ways that are honoring according to them, not according to me, but according to them. And I think that's difficult.
And one quick thought on that. That provokes defensiveness in us, doesn't it? And I'm not and no pun intended, I'm not defending the defensiveness. I'm not saying that makes it okay, but I think just to name it, so that way when I recognize that in myself, maybe a similar experience to you've had with Bill Cosby, where my reaction is to like maybe not believe it or to go against it, is just to be able to have the awareness to say, am I getting defensive here because I'm uncomfortable, or I don't know, what's going on?
Yeah, I think that that's right. And I think that, you know, when we read in the article, it seemed to say that there's a tendency for a lot of us to respond to the grievances of others by highlighting our own.
Yeah.
As opposed to just kind of holding space for theirs. I found that in it with myself. Is there some of that happening here in this case?
I think so. And too often we view things like equality through the lens of a zero-sum game, for those who have taken game theory back in college or anything else, where a benefit for someone else means a loss for me. Mm. And I understand why we look at life that way. And certainly there are many zero-sum games, quote unquote, that we face. But I think when it comes to gender equality, when it comes to racial equality, when it comes to creating broad socioeconomic opportunities, there are ways to think about those issues that are zero sum, but I think those are unhealthy. And I don't think we need to view, especially those who are in historically privileged positions, we don't need to view an increase in kind of social capital for marginalized groups as some sort of threat to us. We don't have to view it through that lens. Last question I want to ask you on this topic, Pastor Judah, you work with young adults. if we've got all of our men going right, all of our women going left, what the heck does this mean for dating and relationships and marriage?
Yeah, it's funny because it actually comes up more often than you would think, where I'll, you know, have young people ask me how to engage with their partner on a particular issue because they have a very different viewpoint. And some of that I think is healthy. So a part of it is I think that we need to always be in relationships with people who are different than us, mm-hmm. right? It's really important that men are talking to and in relationship with women. And in the church, sometimes we struggle with that because we, you know, kind of are trying to keep the kids from having sex all the time. So we're like, hey, men, you go over there and talk to men, and women, you go over there and talk to women. And I think there actually needs to be more skill building in talking to one another, engaging with one another. And that extends beyond just gender, ethnicity, class, political ideology, all of that. It's going to be really important because I think the more you engage with people and have relationships with them, it is a different thing if, say, my friend, my ministry partner, Candace, has a position that her having a particular position is going to mean more to me yeah. because she and I have a relationship because yeah. I love her. She loves me. We're doing life together. And so it creates a little more space for me to deeply consider what she said. And sure, still, I might say, hey, I disagree with that. And I just don't think that that's the way. But at least I have given myself and her the broadest opportunity for engaging with each other and understanding each other so that we can be in alignment. Because ultimately, I think everybody wants to live in a world that's safe, wants to live in a world that's fair, wants to live in a world where we all have equitable access to resources. And so if we can all agree on that, then, and we're in relationship with each other, then we can figure out how to get there.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Last thing I want to say on this topic, we're Christians. Mm. We don't belong to the right or to the left. I think I agree with everything you said about diversity. I think there's another side of this where we go, part of our call as followers of Christ is to recognize Jesus looks to the right and to the left and says, come follow me.
Yeah, it's good.
That's not to say that all of our disagreements melt, but we are called as Christ followers to go up toward Jesus, not out to the right and not out to the left. And we can show people a better way.
That's right. So normally we would have a segment where we talk about a theological issue, but we went a little long with our previous segment. So for this week, we are skipping that section and we're going to jump right into a section that I really love, which is the section where we try to have a little fun and bring a little levity to your day and to our own days. We're going to play a game called I Know You're Lying. Pastor Brian, how do we play?
Feel free to play along with us at home. We had our friend Amanda Beck send us five different categories, and Pastor Judah and I are each going to pick a category, and then we're going to go back and forth saying how many items we can name that fit within that category, and then when one of us thinks the other is lying and cannot make good on that promise, we will say, I know you're lying, and then they will have to identify the number of items in that category that they said they can do. We just looked at the list that Miss Amanda sent us within the last 5 minutes, and we each get to pick one. Pastor Judah, what is the category you are going to choose?
All right. So our first category is going to be types of flowers. Types of flowers.
That's how right. many can you name?
I can name three.
I can name five.
I can name eight.
You don't look very confident.
I'm very confident.
I'm not that confident I can get to nine. So I think you're lying. Go ahead.
All right, here we go. Roses, chrysanthemums, lilies, sunflowers. Daffodils, lilacs, purple hibiscus flowers. And I need one more. Help me, Lord. Help me, Lord. Dandelions are not flowers, they're weeds. Oh God. Wait, I'm like one short. I know there's another flower.
Everyone listening is shouting out names of flowers right
now. Did I say chrysanthemum?
You sure did.
Okay. Peace lilies.
Peace lilies. I think you're just making up flowers now.
No, that's a real thing.
Okay, the category that I am picking, tempted to choose WNBA players, although I don't think I know that many more than you do. And countries that won the World Cup, I would not be great at either. U.S. presidents.
All right. How many can you name?
I can name five.
Jesus. already? Five? I can name six.
I can name 10.
I know you're lying.
Washington, Adams, Jefferson, Madison, Monroe, Quincy Adams, Jackson, Van Buren, Harrison, Taylor. There's your Tyler, excuse me. There's your first 10.
I don't want to play this
game. I can do this all day. Polk, Taylor, Fillmore, Pierce, Buchanan, Lincoln, Johnson.
And you do a thing where you're trying to read all the biographies, right?
Hayes, Garfield.
This is gross.
20. Thank you, Amanda, for playing right into my wheelhouse with this category. Yes, I have had a nerdy fascination with the U.S. presidency my entire life. And yes, it is a life goal to read a biography or memoir of every U.S. president. I have like 11 down and a bunch to go.
Well, isn't that nice?
Isn't that special? That's right. Well, there's our game. I know you're lying. Hope you enjoyed it. And if you know the 21st president, you can continue with where I started. But thank you for listening. These conversations sure do matter. So please keep having them. We thank you again for being a part of the podcast. Be sure to join us next week. Bye-bye.